I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today I'm speaking with Melvin McLeod. Melvin is the editor-in-chief of the Shambhala Sun and Buddha Dharma, a practitioner's quarterly. He lives in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He's a former network correspondent for the CBC and a graduate of the National Defense College of Canada. And he's the editor of a wonderful collection called Mindful Politics, A Buddhist Guide to Making the World a Better Place. Welcome, Melvin.
Thank you very much.
Now, we talked a little bit before we came on air about the fact that I've long been interested in these questions. And something I didn't mention was that when I was a monk in Sri Lanka, it was just at the beginning of their civil war. So it was a very disillusioning experience for me, actually, about the connection between Buddhism and politics. And I think I'd like to start there, because most of what you see as a Buddhist politic in the developing world and in India through Japan is Buddhist groups promoting their agenda as Buddhists, or their ethnicity or their nationality. You want to make a distinction between what you're talking about in this book as a Buddhist politic and the politics of Buddhists qua Buddhists?
Well, I'm certainly no expert on Asian Buddhism, and I don't know that I'd agree with your characterization that most Buddhists in traditionally Asian countries are promoting a nationalist or identity politics agenda. So I basically just like to leave that aside and deal with the community that I'm a part of and the community which is reflected in this book, which is the community of Western Buddhist practitioners.
Well, that's fine. I don't mean to depress you into that, but it is one of the things that's long been on my mind, this distinction. But maybe we can get at it indirectly. Let's start with one quandary that I suppose most people would have, and many Buddhists would probably have, about this this kind of investigation, which is that Buddhism is portrayed as a very otherworldly kind of faith, as many faith traditions actually have that dimension. And so the idea that there would be a Buddhist politic, I think, would strike some as odd if the ultimate solution to all problems is spiritual or inner transformation. Why be concerned about politics in the first place?
Well, I'd have to say that, first of all, that was based on a significant misunderstanding of what Buddhism is. It's far from being otherworldly. It's entire philosophy and practice is based on connecting to the immediate realities of our lives, of our world, and of our mental experience. Actually, because it has no concepts of things like heaven or hell in the theistic sense, or of God, I would argue in a way that it's the least otherworldly of all religions, since it's concerned only with the reality that we directly experience from moment to moment. And of course, the great traditions of the Mahayana in particular, but also of the Theravada, are substantially based on the principle of compassion and of putting others before oneself. And so the healing of the world's wounds, the remediation of suffering, are fundamental principles really to all schools of Buddhism, but are in fact the very basis of all the great Mahayana traditions. Now, the final point that you raise of, shall we say, the outer work of politics or social activism versus the inner work of personal liberation, I think from a Buddhist point of view, is a false dichotomy. The Buddhist view might simply be that in order to help people, first you have to kind of clean up your own mess, and by which I mean work with your own mind and your own neurosis. So I think the only caution that Buddhism might put on taking an active political or social role is that you should make sure that you're not going to go out and make the world worse, that you should deal with your own passion and aggression and ignorance, should deal with your own sense of egocentrism or selfishness, so that you can reach the point where you can genuinely be of help to others. So that's the connection between inner and outer work, not that they're mutually exclusive.
Many of Buddhist scholars have looked back on the history of the Buddhist tradition and distinguished between the Theravadan dominant form, which is that the Sangha is separate from the state and provides legitimacy to the state, and the state gets involved sometimes in assuring the purity of the Sangha and so forth. There's the idea of the Dharma Raja, or the royal ruler, versus the Tibetan tradition, which took this distinctive turn where the Dalai Lama became a secular ruler. Now, the Shambhala Sun is affiliated with a Tibetan tradition. Do you think that this gives you do you recognize that distinction? Is there a difference between the Tibetan approach to Buddhist politics and a more Theravadan approach?
I would have to say that, again, from our conversation, you have had more experience, direct experience, with Buddhist politics in Asia, particularly within the Theravadan world, and I couldn't necessarily comment on that. The only thing that I could say is that, and I'm not sure that it differs among the schools of Buddhism, but that you would argue that a parallel might be that if you had a view that the religion was separate from the society, a parallel question might be whether certain types of activities, such as politics, business, sports, sex, whatever, were somehow secular as opposed to religious or spiritual kinds of activities. And my understanding of Buddhism, at least, is that in the end, there's no such distinction between spiritual or secular, tainted and untainted kinds of activities, that in their fundamental nature, all the activities that we undertake in life can be approached from an enlightened point of view, that the only real difference is the state of mind we bring to bear on them, that nothing is inherently impure or pure.
Well, that's a good segue to my next question, which is about the question of nonviolence. And in the Catholic tradition, they're developed, and it's carried over into Protestantism, this idea of a just war theory, that there is a rationale for war within the ethical teachings of those faiths. And it's often said that Buddhists have never fought a war in the name of Buddhism. I think historically that's a little questionable, but
it is indeed. And what questions you've raised about Sri Lanka, even the current situation, clearly demonstrates that we have examples of Buddhists who are causing conflict.
Right. But even within the Western Buddhist context, just the kinds of arguments and views that are expressed in this wonderful collection that you've put together, I think there's a general assumption that Buddhists would be pacifistic. Do you necessarily share that? Do you think there is a just war theory implicit within Buddhism as well?
I'm not sure that pacifism and just war theories are, in fact, the exact pairing we should be discussing here, but certainly the discussion, I don't believe there are any essays in the book that I edited that actually present a pacifistic point of view. Far from being, I believe, the majority opinion of Buddhists around the world or of Buddhist schools, I believe that it's a minority opinion. Indeed, like all religions, there's a vast spectrum in how people approach, you could say, the ethics of a particular religion. What does it mean to love? What does it mean? What does it mean? What does non-aggression mean? Does non-aggression always mean that no force can be used? I'm no expert on St. Augustine or just war theories per se, but I do know that all the Mahayana schools of Buddhism, at least, in which case we're talking about the Buddhism of Tibet, of China, of Japan, of Vietnam, and I guess parts of Cambodia, do acknowledge that when approached with the right frame of mind, that it can be appropriate, in effect, in defense of oneself or of others, to use force. And my own teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, said, for instance, that if he was sitting in front of the man, or woman, I suppose, more likely the man, who was about to put their finger on the button, push the button of the bomb, he would gladly kill them. And my personal view is that anybody who would say differently would have to examine whether their own personal sense of righteousness was worth millions of lives. So I don't think the vast majority of Buddhists in the world, and I don't believe Buddhist philosophy generally, espouses a pure pacifistic view. What it does advocate is a view of non-aggression, which is to say non-aggression. I don't know what else it says. But it means you don't cause a war. You don't start a war. You don't attack. But whether you can defend, I think you can, and I think the vast majority of Buddhists in the world think you can do justly.
I'm speaking with Melvin McLeod. He's the editor of Mindful Politics, A Buddhist Guide to Making the World a Better Place, which is a wonderful collection of dozens of essays by Buddhists from many different Western and Eastern Buddhist traditions. One of the authors I see here, speaking of this particular topic, is Rita Gross, who's been one of the foremost Buddhist feminist scholars, and she has an essay in here, The Wisdom in the Anger.
Yes.
Comes out of the Tibetan tradition herself, I understand.
Yes.
And one of the points that she's always emphasized is the notion of the transmutation of negative emotions into positive, and in particular in a feminist context, that feminists need empowerment. And I think this is one of the interesting points about Buddhism and politics for me, is that it seems a lot of politics is driven by anger, resentment, conflict. And there's this point in Buddhism about transmuting that anger into something more positive, into a more positive kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say something about that?
Yes. I mean, it's important to note that she, and I think other Buddhists were not really talking about finding a use for anger per se, but embedded in anger, at the basis of anger, as there is in all emotions, is an intelligence and a wisdom. And in the case of anger, often it is the wisdom of clarity and of sharp, accurate analysis, often to analyze and understand an injustice that has been committed, such as the injustice of gender discrimination. The neurotic, shall we say, ego-driven, and most importantly, counterproductive elements of that emotion can be winnowed out or clarified or separated, stepped back from, but the power of the analysis and of the clarity and the strength at the root of that emotion and at the root of the analysis can be maintained. And I think the Buddhist view is that all emotion, really, in the end, as we experience it, we can experience it in a destructive or neurotic way, but at its basis is an energy that is wise and ultimately enlightened.
You also have an essay in here by Sam Harris, who's the
yes.
author of this very controversial book, The End of Faith,
yes.
which is a very militant critique of the role of religiosity in exacerbating conflict in the
Indeed.
World. And he argues that we need to that the Enlightenment needs to be carried forward, and that we need to further secularize the world in order to establish the kind of basis for peace in the world. And
yes.
he has positive things to say about Buddhism, because he doesn't see it as quite as enamored of all these superstitious identities.
Well, he is indeed a Buddhist himself.
He is a Buddhist. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, this I think is another point, that the notion that do you yourself see Buddhism as one of many faith traditions that can lead to the same, are you kind of Unitarian about the role of Buddhism in creating a peaceful world, or do you see a unique message coming out of Buddhism? He seems to think that the theocratic or the theocentric religions, the theistic religions,
yes.
have a uniquely negative role in the world, whereas Buddhism has a different kind of role in the world because it has a more rationalistic and humanistic ethos.
Well, I think the argument that he's making in this essay, though, is that, which I don't necessarily agree with, by the way, although I know him and like him, and I think he makes a very, very valuable contribution to the political discussion taking place in the United States, going far beyond the role of Buddhism. But in the context of this book, he makes an interesting argument that by casting itself as a religion, even though he would argue that ultimately it wasn't in the conventional sense, that Buddhism exacerbates and reinforces the whole construct of religion, which itself is damaging and potentially disastrous in the 21st century when combined with modern-day means of destruction. Now, you know, so he would argue that ultimately Buddhism isn't a religion in that sense, and it would be better to cast itself as a psychology or as a science, and would then be able to bring into the society its great assets and contributions without contributing to the religiosity which he sees as so dangerous. That's the argument that he's making in this case.
Yeah, his work raises this question that's often addressed by Western Buddhists, which is that Buddhism is changed every time it enters into a new culture. When it entered into China, it had this encounter with Confucianism and Taoism, and both its internal doctrines and its internal monastic structures and its social ethics were influenced by those faiths. And when it got to Japan and Tibet and so on.
Yeah.
As it's gotten to the West, one of the things that's happened quite dramatically is a confrontation with feminism, a confrontation with the democratic and egalitarian ethos of the Enlightenment.
Yes.
Much of which we found parallels for in early Buddhism. But do you think that there is, you know, that this is a part of the agenda of the Buddhist politics discussion, is to explore what Buddhism can learn from the European Enlightenment as much as what we can learn from the Buddhist, the implicit Buddhist ethics?
I think there are certain things that Buddhism, with its medieval roots and its roots in more traditional Asian cultures, can draw from the Western political and social ethics, but I'd have to argue that Buddhism has much more to contribute to America than America has to contribute to Buddhism. I strongly believe that the greatest contribution which the contemporary world is making to Buddhism is in bringing to Buddhism unprecedented levels of gender equality. And I would say not just unprecedented in the history of Buddhism, but unprecedented among all religions of all time, in all times. I don't think you'll find many comparable cases, and Unitarianism may be one of them, in fact, comparable to Western Buddhism today in terms of the role of the leadership role, the teaching role that is being taken by women now in Western Buddhism. So I think that will, to my mind, be the great contribution that the meeting of the West and of Buddhism will make to Buddhism.
Mm.
And to be honest, I think that otherwise we have far more to learn from Buddhism than vice versa.
This question of patriotism and nationalism, I subscribe to Tricycle magazine, and they've run a number of articles over the years about whether Buddhists can be patriots and what it means to be patriotic in the context of 9/11 and so forth. There is a critique of all identities in Buddhism. That's kind of the central ontological or metaphysical point of Buddhism, is a critique of identity. And you know, this seems to carry over into a critique of identifying with a country or identifying with a race or a species even. I see that as one of the distinctive contributions of Buddhism as well. Do you think that makes it difficult for Buddhists to be patriotic? It's certainly what the Chinese Confucianists thought.
Well, I think it should be difficult for Buddhists to be patriotic to the extent that they would think that patriotism was some sort of absolute value. There's an interesting article in the current issue of another Buddhist magazine, the Shambhala Sun, that's on the newsstands now, which is about mindful politics, and it's a profile of the well-known American Buddhist and professor and celebrity, in a way, intellectual celebrity, Robert Thurman. And he makes the very interesting point that he doesn't wish to be cast in the role, in effect, to be bound by his temporary identity as an American. If you see life from a longer point of view than a single lifetime, then his identity now, his status as an American, is merely a transient phenomena, as indeed Buddhism sees all phenomena as transitory. And he says, you know, next lifetime I may be an Iraqi, next lifetime I may be another, you know, whatever. So I think that's a very good point. I think all forms of identity have to be seen ultimately as conditioned and as impermanent. And I don't know what patriotism means. I can't say that Buddhism, I mean, why should you have loyalty only to one particular group of people who reside in a particular geographic area or share with you a common language? One thing I talk about in the book is that there's a very important aspiration in Buddhism known as the four Brahma Viharis, which is basically the wish for all beings to have happiness. for all beings not to have suffering, for all beings to experience equanimity, and for all beings to experience joy. And the key part of that, as a, and you could argue as a political platform, what makes it exceptional is the all beings part. It's not all beings who share with me a place of birth, a language, a gender, a class, a race, whatever. It's all beings.
Or humanness. It's also a critique of speciesism.
Indeed, that, well, critique, I don't know if it's a critique. That's a very American way of looking at things, to turn them into sociological
arguments and critiques. Battles and
it's
things
an like aspiration
that.
Of the heart. But I suppose at a somewhat more superficial level, it's a critique as well of an ism. But yes. So in that sense, I suppose. Now, where I think it gets interesting is going back to that question of wisdom and of neurosis that we discussed before. It's possible that peoples and cultures have particular characters. And I also think it's possible to say that we have neuroses. I'm a Canadian. We have our own neuroses. And we have our own wisdoms. And I think rather than the question being whether I'm patriotic as a Canadian, it's that I see what the Canadian national character is in an accurate way. And I see, with some humor, it's neurosis, which I could go on about at some length, as well as the American, and as well celebrate and feel proud of its wisdom. And I think that's where Buddhism comes to on the question of patriotism, to see accurately the national character, both its neurotic aspect as well as its enlightened aspect.
So you can love and appreciate your fellow countrymen, but not necessarily have an exclusive ethical identity with them.
Absolutely not. And to be honest, have a sense of humor about the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, you know, in a way, yeah, joking about ethnicity has, particularly if it's one's own, has something real to recommend it.
Let me cut
through the sense of permanence and solidity and self-righteousness about national identity.
Let me go back to species for a second, because one of the things that has been a connection for many Western Buddhists with politics has been the environmental movement and deep ecology in particular. And it's troubled me over the years, and there have been other Buddhists who've written about this, that there is an implicit dualism in a lot of environmental politics that sees human beings as a problem in existence, as opposed to at least an equally valuable part of existence, if not one of the, you know, the moral focuses of existence. And I don't know if you've given any thought to this, but do you think that some Buddhists, in identifying with the environmental movement, have taken that misanthropic turn that nature is more valuable than humanity? Humanity's a problem, is a cancer, that kind of thing.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I think generally the majority of Western or convert Buddhists in North America come from, well, often they're baby boomers now, but come from a particular demographic, which is generally quite liberal. So I would say often they may reflect the views of that class, and there's a strong Bay Area, component. But and I agree with you, I think there can be a misanthropic view of it. I mean, but it's nothing to do with Buddhism. Remembering that Buddhism says that even though we suffer and we are confused and we cause pain to ourselves and to others because we are blinded by our belief in the solidity of ourself and the world that we experience, and therefore are continually interacting with it on the basis of passion and of aggression and of ignorance. Nonetheless, beneath that, we have an essence that is awake and compassionate and wise and aware, and that represents what our true nature is as human beings. So I don't think any Buddhist can ultimately be a hater of human beings or a denigrator of human beings. Quite the opposite. A Buddhist sees all human beings as fundamentally Buddhist.
You can only achieve enlightenment as a human being, not as an animal or a god.
I don't know.
Well, that's the orthodox teaching.
Yeah. That is correct. It is the orthodox view of some schools. But either way, undoubtedly, we have to say that we must revere in a way and treat with great care and kindness human beings, and never to say that they're a plague upon this world.
Okay, we're coming to the end here, but I want to press this question of, I know that you're not an expert on Asian politics, but let me ask you this. There's a Buddhist monk party in the Sri Lankan parliament right now.
Yeah.
And do you think that is consistent? You know, do you think that there's also a Buddhist party in Japan? There's the Kometo, which comes out of the Nichiren tradition. They have a party that's in the parliament. And do you think it would be consistent with Buddhist idea of Buddhist politics to have a distinctly Buddhist political force? Or are Buddhists, is this more of a book about how Buddhists as individual activists acting within their various spheres of influence?
Well, those are two separate questions. Certainly the book is completely about Buddhists as individuals.
Right.
We're not going to have any Buddhist political parties in North America anytime soon.
Right.
So
they wouldn't go very far.
This is the first title that I considered for this book was The Mindful Citizen. It's as much as anything else a handbook on how to be a citizen. In fact, of course, just simply a handbook on how to live, as it is about politics. The issue of a Buddhist political force gets back to the same point we were making earlier. Is it a sense of solid identity as a Buddhist that separates you from other people? Then no, that's indefensible. If the basis of the Buddhist political party or view or platform were one of peace and of openness and of caring for all beings, that would be perfectly defensible. Now, we know that that ideal is not reached around the world, and that particularly in Sri Lanka today, that as I understand it, conservative Buddhist elements are strongly nationalistic, strongly anti-Tamil. Actually, there was a picture in the New York Times the other day that was quite extraordinary, and it showed some monks being sort of forcibly ejected from a stage at a political rally in Colombo. And you took a look at it, and your assumption was that because the people who were affecting them from the stage looked somewhat agitated, and the people who were being evicted were the monks, that you thought, oh, the monks were the peaceful ones, and they were being ejected by warlike people. In fact, it was exactly the reverse. The monks had interrupted a peace rally and were being ejected from the stage, and they were, in fact, arguing for the war or for the the government in Sri Lanka to take a strongly militaristic position. So that is indefensible.
Yeah.
Because if Buddhism becomes simply another us versus them, then it's no better than anything else.
That's wonderful. And I do want to encourage everyone to take a look at this book because it is a wonderful collection of essays, covers dozens of different kinds of topics from racism to globalization to the role of religion in society. And we've been talking about Mindful Politics, A Buddhist Guide to Making the World a Better Place. We've been talking with the editor, Melvin McLeod, who's the editor also of the Buddhist newspaper Shambhala Sun and Buddha Dharma, a Practitioner Quarterly. He lives in Nova Scotia, in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Thanks so much for joining us, Melvin.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.